afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being with us. You could be anywhere in this world, but you're joining us, so we appreciate you. Welcome to an AstraZeneca online debate hosted by the MEP sat next to me, Christian Soubousoy, with Euractiv as media partner. Now, today we're going to be discussing something that's hugely important for just about, well, everyone around this table, but also all of you, our health and the future of health in Europe, and what it could or should look like in the next political cycle post these very exciting elections that we're all going to be voting in, hopefully, in June. Health, as we know, is a member state competence, but increasingly since the COVID-19 pandemic stress-tested healthcare systems up and down the block, there's a growing consensus in the EU to do more, to affect change and to level up. Let me just give you a little quote here. We cannot wait for the end of the pandemic to repair and prepare for the future. We will build the foundations of a stronger European health union in which 27 countries work together to detect, prepare and respond collectively. And I'm sure everyone perhaps around this table knows that, and perhaps all of you watching as well know, those are the very words of the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen back in 2020. But that was 2020. So where are we at now? Is enough still being done to improve supply chains, increase affordability and access to medicines and life-changing therapies and, of course, medical devices for everyday Europeans, especially for those who are living in rural or far-flung areas where medical deserts or medical desertification is now becoming a greater reality? Does the EU need a more strategic or targeted funding policy beyond the Recovery and Resilience Fund, for example? Now, we know that structures are in place, and you're going to hear from the MEPs and all the people around the table about those structures, from non-legislative initiatives like the European Beating Cancer Plan. I know you'll be very much speaking about that one, or Healthier Together, a non-communicable disease initiative. We also have funding programmes like the 5.3 billion EU for Health programme and legislative proposals like the European Health Data Space and, of course, the revision of that general pharmaceutical legislation. All of these are, of course, welcome changes. We all want better health. But the question for this debate is if the EU really cares about the health of every single person living in the EU, can it now seize a greater momentum to push for radical change, to push for more integration, more coordination, more investment, more resources, grow initiatives that are both budgetary and legislative? Well, that's what I'm going to be asking all of our panelists. But first, of course, we do have some housekeeping. You are, if you haven't noticed, this is being live streamed from this beautiful location here at the European Parliament. Now, it wasn't possible to have a live audience Q&A, but audience, you will be involved. We have taken note of some of your questions, and after the debate with the panelists, we'll come to some of those questions a bit later on. We also have the result of a Slido poll. So let me, first of all, kick off with that before I go to our lovely panelists. So the question we asked you was, in the next five-year cycle, in the next legislative mandate, what should be the top three top priorities for the European Union? Your options were tackling disease through EU action plans, two, increased EU action on prevention, early detection of non-communicable diseases, three, enhanced regulatory framework to improve access to innovative health treatments, and then four, promote strategic autonomy and competitiveness of EU life sciences sector. Now I'm going to ask the panelists here, which one do you think it was? MEPs are cheating. Which one? Anyone have a guess?
I don't want to choose. I want to choose all. No?
Okay,
I
you think want that to all. Choose all. Well, the answer was the first one, tackling disease through EU action plans. And I'm going to ask you all a bit more about that Slido poll in some more detail. So let me first of all introduce you then to our panellists. First of all, as I was saying, we have our host, the EPP MEP, who's also Romanian, Christian Soubousoy. He's also the chair of the ITRIC committee, so the industry committee at the European Parliament, and you're also a member of the SENT committee. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. We were going to have Pernille Weiss, MEP, and she's the, I'm sure everyone's aware, she's not only an MEP, but she's a rapporteur of the European Parliament's Pharma Directive. But unfortunately, she wasn't able to come. I think she had an issue with her passport, so we wish her well and hope that she's made it through customs and nothing nefarious happened to her there. Next to me, Spanish ECR MEP Margarita de la Pisa Carrion. She's a substitute for the Envi Committee. Welcome. We also have Richard Price. I know I've spoken to you before, I think at a previous Euractiv panel. He's the head of policy at the European Cancer Organization. Last but not least, lovely lady who I've also been in conversation with before, Magda Klebus. She's the executive director, science policy and regulatory affairs at FPIA, which is, of course, one of the biggest pharma lobbies that we have here based in Brussels. Okay, so I'm going to give you all the floor. So I'll kick off with our host, MEPB Bussoy. Please go ahead for your opening statement.
Once again, thank you for the initiative, and I'm happy to be here to look ahead to the future, but also see what was accomplished in the last years. I totally agree, and I totally support your statement that the pandemics opened the eyes of European citizens. Actually, even before the pandemics, all the Eurobarometers show that more than 80% of the European citizens consider healthcare as an important issue that should be tackled at the EU level also. Of course, healthcare is extremely important for every one of us. Citizens know that the decisions are made in the member states, sometimes in the regional and local authorities, but at the national level most of the time. But they wanted European institutions to be more involved. The pandemic showed that we need coordination, we need more resilience, we need to put together resources, we need to have solidarity, and national authorities, but also European institutions representatives that were not necessarily involved in the healthcare area, like the Commissioner for Health or others involved in health policies, understood that they need to devote more attention to healthcare. So healthcare emerges as a key area for EU policy in the last 4 years, at least since 2020. We had important achievements, the program EU for Health. I know it well because I was the rapporteur of European Parliament, and maybe it will be an opportunity to discuss a little bit more about the priorities of this program. You mentioned the revision of the pharma legislation. General pharma legislation will vote soon in Strasbourg, the European Parliament position as a basis for negotiations with the Council for the next mandate, and most probably in the second part of the in the second part of the year, but after the new EU institutions will be in place. And the European Health Data Space, an important success, and the enhanced role of EMA, of European Medicine Agencies, with a special attention on the fees. We managed to have a good balance there, and I was proud as rapporteur to have a good cooperation with the member states, with the council, with the national authorities, and a stronger role of ECDC as new pandemics or new threats could appear in the future.
Okay, thank you so much. And I'll definitely pick up on some of those files that you were talking about. Over to MEP De La Pisa, carry on, please.
As Mr. Rousseau said, it's true that the pandemic, it changed the perspective of the importance, you know, of the and health became an issue. Before, the environment, MB committee calls environment because it was more environment oriented. No, it's true that also there was on the agenda this special committee of beating cancer plan, that it was a really good special committee because we had 1 year to have conversation, have a space for professionals, and we could deliver to the society, to our citizen, a European strategy that can enlighten European national strategies in our member states. I know that it was really welcome, and I think that as you mentioned, it's great that the next mandate have this concern to work with different diseases and go deeper in and have strategies, because we try to foster a cardiovascular special committee, or at least to have a European strategy to afford the cardiovascular disease as the first cause of death. As we see with Becca, to implement this, maybe in each mandate two special topics or about the different disease. Mental health have been something that we touch, but spread in different committees, ample committee, but never as something that give a space of 1 year of communication, professional coming, because all of these working groups create relations between stakeholders, politicians, the lawmakers, because as I see, sometimes we have a lack of time to know each other, to understand the problems, the needs. So sometimes the politicians deliver reports that have not the really needs of the people on the ground and the professional that can enrich this. And in this special committee, we have the opportunity to understand each other, give space, and that's why we could bring into the society such a comprehensive report that enlightens the national strategy. And I think that this way of work, it's very important to implement this as a way to work in the parliaments, because we see in other reports that we have like maybe 3 months. For example, pharma legislation happened to us. We need to understand better the problematic to deliver a good text. And also because we see that the medical society sometimes work by in their space. They have a huge European cooperation. Then the politician by their own, but never together. And to give the space to join the worlds, I think that is a responsibility that we all have, because as Bourseau said, the health is a topic, is an awareness that all of us have. Everybody will, all citizens will appreciate seeing the politician trying to working to bring solution or trying to bring better solution. Also, the investment at European level for investigation, for creating new therapeutics tools will be welcome, of course, and everybody will enrich of that. So I think that health is our responsibility also as European unions to learn a way to cut the collaboration between member states, sharing good practice, and trying to create an environment where the health standards become the best of the world.
So connection, collaboration and conversation, three C's. I like what you said. Can I also just quickly ask you, are you standing for election?
We'll see. It's
we'll
true
see.
That
okay.
There are a lot of uncertain, so now we are thinking to close this mandate. It's true to have this. I think I appreciate a lot that you prepared this event, because I think that we need to foster the health topic as an important topic for the next mandate. And we'll see if we have the chance, but the citizens have the voice, no? And then this,
indeed,
now we have
indeed.
To finish what we are
and
working
I,
with.
And I understand you're also going to be standing.
After 17 years in European Parliament, I'll go back to national politics.
Okay.
I was just appointed the president of my party in Timișoara region, mm-hmm. in the west of Romania, but I remain connected to European policies.
Okay,
and
no, it's good to know that as we discuss about, you know, what the EU should do next, to have the different perspective of who's going to stand, who's not going to stand. So you will have the member state perspective in our conversation. Okay, good to know. Okay, over to Richard then, for your opening statement, please.
Well, yeah, thank you for the invitation to the event. I think it's very timely. It feels like New Year's Eve for the Brussels bubble. We're looking back and we're looking forward at the same time. And I think as we look back on the last 4 years, everything's changed. COVID-19 changed everything. I think the EU really proved itself in terms of what it can do to support countries, both in times of crisis, but also in terms of generally in healthcare and improving access for patients to many forms of treatment. Simultaneously to that, you had Europe's Beating Cancer Plan, which smashed paradigms because it showed what happens when we focus EU health policy around key targets and goals and what that can do to galvanise a community, but also express political unity. And I think here in the Parliament, we saw that with the Beating Cancer report. People from all parties, they're all affected by cancer. We're all stakeholders in that. And it was great to see such coming together over the last 5 years. So I hope we see that in the next 5 years, and that's part of our campaign, Time to Accelerate.
Indeed. Okay, and then finally to Magda then.
Thank you. And like everybody else, I could actually steal the words from all of you and feel proud about it. Health, indeed, with COVID, had become, I think, on the top, but now, is it still, and are we at a risk of actually losing some of that because other political and economic questions are taking precedence and advantage? And I'd like to say that my big lesson from COVID was that health is not alone. It's interconnected with so many other things, and it's interconnected with R&D, with science, with data, with industry, with academia, and therefore that connectivity that we have created during COVID should be maintained and not get lost. And we need all of these elements in order to get not only better outcomes and better health for the citizens, because that's what we all want. We want better health for everyone, but also we want Europe as a place where new health solutions are being delivered and are being developed, because that in turn benefits patients, it benefits research ecosystem, it benefits healthcare systems, it benefits the economy. So I think that these are the lessons from COVID that we cannot lose. And the other lessons from COVID, which some of you have mentioned, is that we have done during these last 4 or 5 years a lot of things, including through the pharma legislation review, modernizing the regulatory framework because we want Europe to be as attractive as it can be, or creating the European health data space, creating EU for health, Horizon Europe, which put health very much at the forefront, biopreparedness and creation of HERA, that's a very big and important signal to everyone. But we need to be very careful not to fall into the trap of not seeing the risks, and the risks are there, that if there is no sufficient balance, if we don't have predictability, long-term certainty for all actors, public and private, if we don't have a long-term vision and prioritize health and look at it holistically, chronic diseases and infectious diseases are also connected, and there are many interfaces and interplays. And if we don't create more consistency in the European legislation across silos, not just health, but health, research, environment, data, everything else, then Europe might not be as quick at attracting both better outcomes and better research.
Lovely. OK, well, I'm going to ask the two non-MEPs this then. So MEP de la Pisa Carrion, she mentioned, I'm taking it as three C's now, so collaboration, connection, conversation. But I'll come to Richard first. Do you feel as if politicians in Europe, whether they're MEPs or we're looking at, you know, the other institutions as well, do you feel as if your voice as a European organisation has been heard in the conversations you've had?
Yes, I would say we have been, but that's been partly because of the context that we've had. There was a political commitment from the very top, from the Commission President, and all the way through to have it been in Cancer Plan, which meant, of course, that cancer organisations were involved in that. And I think the Commission did entirely the right thing by spending a year consulting with the community about what should be in that plan, and that was an approach that we were pleased to see, because when the plan came out, it reflected a lot of the things that they would have heard, not only from our organisation, but many others, and not only cancer organisations, but organisations connected to cancer care and delivery. So I think we have been heard. I think the Parliament has certainly taken a strong interest in the topic and been listening to all the stakeholders, so really I couldn't complain there. But you need the framework, you need the target, the goal, the political commitment on a subject, which from then on stakeholders can be heard.
And is it too early to see the effects of the Beating Cancer Plan? I mean, when you talk to patients, are they feeling this now, or do they simply at this stage just have the hope that Europe is taking action when it comes to beating cancer?
Sure. Well, there was, of course, 1 year spent on consultation, so we're now 3 years into the plan, and lots of foundations laid, but really both legislation that was passed here on air pollution, asbestos, occupational carcinogens, but also soft power around recommendations on cancer screening, for example, and then funding for things like the EU network of comprehensive cancer centres. So different things are coming through at different times. But it's also very interesting to see the galvanising effect it can have on national governments. So you set a goal to, for example, eliminate HPV cancers. It's just a goal. But at national level, countries are responding to that. Greece most recently announced that they would have HPV gender-neutral vaccination. Countries across Europe are now feeling that there's a new norm. So that didn't cost any taxpayers funding to make that goal or commitment, but it's really triggered very interesting things at national level, the same on cancer screening.
Yeah, and definitely, you know, you need to have that, especially when it comes to cancer, because, you know, the cancer patients themselves, they need that hope. They can't just have people like you, you know, looking after their needs. They need everyone to be, you know, giving them essentially a hug and taking care of them with of course, their illness. So, Magda, then, coming to you then, do you feel, coming from the other side, as you know, as part of a pharma lobby, do you feel as if Well, I'm sure politicians do listen to you guys, but do you feel as if the conversations that you are having have been fruitful? And perhaps if you look towards the next legislature, what would you like the improvements perhaps in conversations and dialogue?
I think there were many conversations that were held and with policymakers from the Commission, the European Parliament, now with the Council. So I think there is a lot of conversations that that took place, and a lot of the things that we were saying have been heard. But I think now the trick is in making something that would achieve all goals. I had the impression that at one point there was the impression that it's either access or innovation or new healthcare solutions. And I think it's both at the same time, and we need to create that balance that would allow both to be nurtured here in Europe, because it is important, as I said before, health cannot live with innovation, innovation cannot live with health, so it's interconnected. And therefore, do we understand that if we don't have continued investment into research in Europe, we are not necessarily going to achieve the health objectives that we aim for? I'm not sure that that voice had been heard, and that the understanding that Europe unfortunately still lags behind and needs to retrieve its competitiveness, the one that it had 20, 30 years ago, needs to be balanced through the different measures that we are taking now. And just let me give you two examples. One would be definitely through the pharmaceutical legislation review, where we need to create that balance where Europe remains attractive and stable and predictive for the economic operators who can come. And another example, European health data space, which is a fantastic intent, but if not everyone has access to it, it would not play its role to the extent that it's needed. And I can multiply the examples.
Well, let's first of all go to that quite contentious, perhaps, or perhaps not so much, EU pharma legislation then. Obviously, as I was saying, the author of the Parliament's directive isn't sitting with us now. But let me... there's a quote from FBI, I think, in one of your articles online, which says, if the EU pharma legislation goes ahead in its current form, then Europe is set to lose another one-third of its R&D by 2040. So picking up on what you just said, and that's going to cost Europe around $2 billion a year. Now, I asked this same question, to, as I was saying, to Natalie Moll. There was a lot of criticism of this pharma legislation. I've spoken to various different groups, different actors in this, and there was this sort of consensus that perhaps the European Commission had been, I don't know, making decisions in a vacuum, and it wasn't really listening to industry, etc., about how this would actually affect. And you mentioned the word predictability. So do you think any of these changes that the Parliament's then been working on their two dossiers, is it looking better now for Europe?
It certainly looks very good. And I should say that the Commission has listened to the voice of the sector in terms of improving the regulatory processes, future-proofing the regulatory framework, making sure that Europe is helping the innovation and the innovators, whether from public or from private sector, to come, to accelerate, to remove redundancies. The Commission has done a very good job at proposing that. And I think that the Parliament has brought even further improvements to some of these files. I don't want to go into the details, but there are some very important improvements. On the other hand, we have this undermining of some of the incentives, which were the important piece that made Europe different from other regions, which were making Europe competitive. That has been actually undermined. And now, can the improvements outweigh the loss? Not completely,
no, you're not
I would
convinced,
say.
No.
I'm not convinced. No,
no. You're not convinced. You're a substitute for the ENVI committee. I mean, I believe the ENVI committee voted through its report last month, and now, of course, this dossier is going to the plenary, I believe, next week. Which one of your MPs would like to take the question on the pharma legislation?
Both, I think.
Both? Okay, we'll come. Okay, ladies first then.
Okay, I think that pharma legislation is not only pharma legislation. We have to also see the environment that Europe has for the industry. And I I have the same concern about the incentive, because it's true that we are decreasing the rights that the industry has already.
And what we're discussing before, here for the viewers, this RDP, the Regulatory Data Protection.
Yes, yes. Yeah, okay. But also because it's true that we are in all of this mandate, there are a lot of legislation that have been developed that we work with that became a burden for the industry, and not only industry, also the primary sector. We see that this decision that the Commission makes and propose and legislation that go through this during this mandate having very bad secondary effects. As we are seeing now, we have a lack of principal actives. Also, we have lack of medicines. We have, but also we have sometimes lack of special resources. You know, we see in the pandemic, but we are seeing already now. So why it's happening this? Because the competitiveness of our sector, industry, primary, is being affected, because the burdens that we are, that our companies are facing, not affect to the third one. So it's becoming easier to go out from Europe, so that but it's mean poverty for us, because means less employment opportunity, less prosperity. The business are going out from our, so we are destroying our market. So I mean, market is also health, because what I would like as pharmaceutical is to as I said at the beginning, to create an environment that welcome the investment, welcome the opportunities, welcome us as professional that worth to have opportunities of investigation in our European environment. And as we are seeing, it's decreasing. But instead of changing the line, we are reinforcing the line. So it's becoming, the problem is becoming bigger. So you can say now at the end of mandates, I want to build competitiveness. Mm-hmm. But you have been working all this last mandate to destroy the competitiveness of our country,
yeah.
of our European Union.
Yeah.
So it's not just pharma legislation. We see all of this green legislation that also makes difficulties for the companies. Also, we see in EPO committee. So there are these
companies and farmers, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, so it's becoming any activity in Europe, it's becoming more and more difficult. And as we see this communication that we talk about in BECA, sometimes it's not present in other more important reports as a directive or as a regulation. That is where it's needed in the pharma legislation. I think that there's a lack of conversation between stakeholders and the Commission, because now we are dealing with these problems, the deputies, because we see that there are huge differences between the positions each other. But because also we don't have the real impact assessment. So if you don't know the impact of the measures or the legislation, how you as politician can decide? And as we are seeing, we took a lot of measure that now see that have a terrible impact in other sectors. For example, motor. We see our industry of motor is going away from Europe. Our energy strategies, industry. So I mean, it's not just health, but it's also health, because if you have not prosperity, if you have not a good environment, of course that this will affect the health of the people.
Yeah.
Because even a country will have not even money to pay the treatments. So I think that Europe worth better management than we had this last mandate. And we'll see with this communication if we reinforce this way of work. And pharma legislation is a very important thing. We will have the vote next plenary. But it's also we are not showing a good way to work with, because it's an end of mandate where the trilogues will not take place, because the composition of the parliament that we are going to will going to deal with will be other. So it's not serious. I mean, it's not serious to put in the agenda of the parliament at the end of mandate something that is such an important issue for the health and for the patient, because we are not going to finish
so
with...
So MEP Bissoy then, to get your thoughts on then. Do you think this legislation then gets lost? Because if it's already so tricky, it's already got so many things that people are trying to sort of amend, make amendments to, you know, it's just not working. And then I think I was speaking to Magda earlier. We were talking about, you know, the kind of data on this. China already outspends the EU by over 300 billion euros in R&D. And there was a recent Financial Times article today that said the EU rules are driving pharma backers to the US. So is this legislation for you? And as you're saying, someone that's now moving towards national healthcare or national politics, is this legislation for you? When you look at your, perhaps your member state country, is it something that will perhaps increase innovation, whether it's cross-border innovation or...
Comparing to the initial proposal of European Commission and also to many discussions threats that we heard during the debates in European Parliament, I think we are going in the good direction. Okay. I was also the rapporteur for the opinion of the ITRE Committee on Pharma Strategy, mm-hmm. which was the precursor of the legislative phase. And now also I was involved as chair of Industry Research and Energy Committee in the opinion of ITRE Committee to add to the ENVI report. From the perspective of the Industry Committee, it was a vote for innovation. And mm-hmm. clearly the incentives were clearer, and it was a stronger signal to the pharma industry that we support innovation. But I understand also the need to find a balance, because from the perspective of healthcare, of ENVI committee, also from some member states, and you asked about Romania. Romania also has a balanced view, would like to see more innovation, access, quicker access to innovation, but also to look at the sustainability of the budgets and find the right balance between the innovative medicines and generics and biosimilars. As also we need to as I said, to find the right balance. So looking from this perspective also, what was achieved as a compromise in ENVI, it's not the ideal solution, but I think it goes in the right direction. And what is also very important, because our debate is focused also on the future, mm-hmm. is that after finalizing this legislation, and of course, it's just the step, the position of the parliament, then negotiations will follow, and we'll see the final version after the trilogues, is that innovation in healthcare should remain a priority for European institutions. And also when we talk about innovations...
But will it? Because the pandemic is so in everyone's rearview mirror now.
I hope. And when we are talking about...
Where do you see it in the mandate of perhaps the European Commission right now?
Let's see
if
President von der Leyen will continue. Mm. I believe that we have good signs of being optimistic. As she was very, very supportive to healthcare in general, she was a great supporter for you beating cancer plan even before the pandemic.
But she hasn't spoken about it, I think, in her last State of the Union address. She hasn't focused on healthcare. I mean,
because
obviously, the EU is in perma-crisis.
So
yes,
many
there's
challenges
so many
from
going
the
on.
War in
but
Ukraine
as said,
to
one
many
day,
other
every
challenges.
Day, there's going to be a day for each and every one of us.
What is also
doctor,
very important is that European institutions should also focus and try to issue some recommendations to the member states, because access to innovation is not only about incentives on data protection, on patents and so on. It's also the implementation, how long it takes for a medicine to be approved, then how long it takes to be on the reimbursement list in some member states. A lot of bureaucracy, which is a problem for European competitiveness. Mrs. de la Pisa-Carion mentioned the problem of our competitiveness, and you know that European Commission asked Professor Mario Draghi to come with a report, and also former Prime Minister Letta to strengthen the internal market. Mm-hmm. Former Prime Minister looked to four pillars, four domains where we should concentrate more. Telecom, energy, and also financing. Mm-hmm. And I also would say that we need to concentrate on healthcare, also on pharmaceutical industry, as we could be more attractive for innovation, and also to bring back to Europe some of the production capacities that we lost, to be less dependent on other continents, at least on medicines, if it will be impossible to have on active ingredients. But from European institutions, they can pressure to the member states to have less bureaucracy, quicker times, a better implementation of the health technology assessment legislation, to invest more in innovation. And this is something that is not necessary a legislative action, but a day-to-day action of European institutions in the future.
Okay, well, let me ask Richard then. So in a previous Euractiv debate, we were speaking about, I mean, I will get off the pharma legislation a bit, but, you know, because it touches innovation so much. A VC said that when it comes to prevention and rare disease, it's not a solid bet for investors and their shareholders, so they wouldn't invest there. So when it comes to NCDs like diabetes, cancer, Alzheimer's, I mean, this... How do you feel, as we approach this next sort of 5 years, are you hopeful perhaps that this legislation to some effect, I mean, this is a pharma legislation, this is really to get, you know, pharma to innovate, and that innovation then trickles down to the everyday person. But do you think, I mean, this is just one person that I'm quoting, but that doesn't really give that sense that we're going to get that innovation for things like Alzheimer's or rare types of cancers, you could say. Are you hopeful?
Well, I think... There's a few things about the pharma legislation. Mm. One, I think as people go to the ballot boxes in a few months, it's a sign of the system working, that the Commission produced something. It wasn't perfect, and the European Parliament has scrutinised it from many angles and looked to find solutions to some of the imperfections. The other thing about the pharma legislation, it's very wide. It covers lots of issues. There's antimicrobial resistance in there, medicine shortages. But there is this interesting facet about trying to guide innovation a bit more, with new provisions around unmet medical need. And that was something we took a lot of interest in from the cancer perspective, because there are many unmet needs in cancer, many unmet needs in other disease areas too. And if we could see a system that was better orientated towards helping, for example, survival rates from pancreatic cancer or ovarian cancer, well, that's a big win if we can achieve that. But we've got to get the wording right, we've got to get the system right, and the implementation afterwards. It's been 20 years, I think, since the last update of the pharma legislation. I think if we get it wrong, we certainly don't want to be waiting another 20 years to fix that. So the stakes are high, and I hope that the next Parliament can really give attention to some of those very detailed aspects of wording that is 100% right.
Okay, so that's quite... It's positive and hopeful from you, though. There's another aspect within healthcare that 15% of the EU's... 15 million, so 7% of the EU's workforce, work in healthcare. Now, you're probably seeing in the UK, you know, junior doctors are striking. We know that the health workforce feel neglected, also in Europe. It's not just a British problem, it's a European problem. So the people that can empower the gift of healthcare, that can help the kind of people that you... you know, give help to through your organisation, you know, they have bad working conditions, their mental health is affected, and if they aren't feeling good about the place that they're working and the people that they're working for, you know, this, of course, really can badly affect the kind of healthcare that is being provided for everyone. So do you feel that that politicians have looked at the pandemic and made... at least the building blocks of structural changes so that the health workforce can work in an environment that helps them thrive a bit better, or at least not suffer as much in their day-to-day and want to leave their job, especially, for example, nurses?
Okay, well, in my view, I think the health workforce crisis is the number one lesson that we didn't learn from COVID-19. Mm-hmm. We learned about medicine shortages, we learned about product shortages, we're reshoring production, we're putting systems in place to monitor and measure medicines. That's all fantastic. I'm not aware that we're doing much, if anything, at a European level to address the workforce crisis, but it's the same symptom. One country experiences a shortage, it goes to another country to fill in that shortage, and it's robbing Peter to pay Paul. So we're all in this together, but we're not responding to it together. So I really hope that the precedent that we've been able to set in policy following COVID can be followed for the workforce crisis. It's the next agenda, I think, for the next European Parliament and Commission.
So, MEPs, do you think that we can see work, you know, from whether it's a Parliament or perhaps even, you know, directly from the European Commission to help the European workforce in the future?
Yes, clearly here it's also up to the member states to find the right incentives. And the situation is different from one member state to to another. I'm coming from Romania, as you mentioned at the beginning of our debate. Here we have a large exodus of medical workforce to the Western countries. Of course, better conditions to work, better salaries, better professional perspectives. Then we took some measures to increase the salaries, also to introduce some meritocracy into the hospital system, to invest a little bit more in modernizing the curricula in the universities, to connect better our universities and also the post-university system, because many hospitals are university hospitals, so professors, doctors are continuing also both careers. And now the situation is a little bit better, so we found some incentives to keep the workforce in Romania, but we see a shortage of almost everywhere. European institutions can issue recommendations, of course, can also mobilize some funds from Erasmus or from the cohesion funds to pay so for some training programs. Also, EU for Health are looking, is looking at least to build some strategies for the better resilience, and having a strong workforce is part of our future resilience. But I would say that this will be up to the member states to take most of the most efficient measures in order to tackle this issue.
And yeah, go ahead, yeah.
No, I think that it's true that also we have to value this kind of vocation. For example, today in EMPEL committee, we are have been talking about the lack of profiles for certain green and digital transition. But we face also this difficulty to find the professional in the health sector. But we are not talking about this here. And it's not a priority of the European Union. And it means to have more university. In my country, for example, there are hundreds of students that would like to study this kind of profession, and they have not space in the university. So, and also, the society has to see and appreciate and be proud of our profession, because we see that sometimes it happens, sometimes talking about the women, because you know, as you know, there are many times that there are the women that have this kind of vocation. Me as pharmaceutics in my profession, the 98% we are women, but we are always saying that this service profession are not like fancy. Why not? Isn't it? You know, this kind of professional care profession giving, and you know, all the sanitary profession means service, have to be valued by the society. But we are undermined. We are not talking about our health forces, yes, in the pandemic, but not after.
Yeah,
as we see, it's like at that moment, yeah. We saw it, it's a need. But the reality is that in my country, the doctors, the nurses, they are not good salaries, not good work conditions, not society recognitions. It looks like not success life. If you are instead to help them to feel really good and to feel attractive profession, to also encourage youth to become and want to keep, you know, because as we see, sometimes these professionals have to go out of Europe to feel this success experience. Yeah. And it's a pity, because we have really good professionals and at our academy university environment is amazing. So we form and we educate a really good professional, and sometimes we are not using
them. And it's a shame, because it's you know, from every level, from the porter to the specialist, the surgeon, it's such a gift that they all give us. Richard, I think you wanted to say something.
Yeah, well, I sense a little bit on the workforce issue. You sometimes get that same sense of, well, what can the EU do? It's not an EU competence. But we saw that with medicine shortages and other topics in the past, until finally there was a recognition. I want to give an example, which is after the COVID-19 pandemic, there was the establishment of the Health Emergencies Response Authority. This was to really make sure that if there's another pandemic, another health crisis, we don't end up in the same position. And it was given lots of mandate to do MAP, for example, production facilities across Europe in different fields, but nothing on workforce. And when you look to know, if you wanted to know, the number of pathologists, the number of radiologists or hospital pharmacists in a country, that data is not collected. That data is not available. We can't plan for the next pandemic without that sort of response. And I think had that Health Emergency Authority been an official agency and gone through the parliament here, I think the parliamentarians would have picked up on those issues and made a change. So it just shows how important it is that we have not only a strong parliament, but really involved in all of the big decisions. And that was a good case study of where we really could have used the parliament's help on that, yeah. But they weren't given the chance.
Indeed. Magda, any sort of thoughts on this?
I'm just listening to this conversation, yeah. And it mirrors also the other challenge that we have in terms of workforce. It's not in healthcare, but in life sciences in general. Companies today really have difficulty to recruit skilled people in Europe because probably the profession doesn't look that attractive, or people think that maybe it all happens in other geographies and not in Europe anymore. Science is not as attractive, and therefore there are difficulties there. So I think that's another thing that Europe would need to tackle. I very much agree with everything around healthcare workforce because they are partners in delivering better care, managing chronic diseases, and making healthcare systems ready for next generation of health solutions, whether they are medicines or integrated care. They have no time even to actually learn those new things and to optimize because they are just running behind the clock. So I think time and attractiveness, but also in life sciences in general, I think that needs to be sorted. Otherwise, we would have a great science, but lack of people to actually translate this science into the products of the future.
So what would you really like to see if you had like sort of top three conditions for any sort of politician sitting next to us, but also anyone else who might be watching?
Not specifically about the workforce, although that's part of that. The first one is really to invest in science and life science to start with. And that's both from European level, but more importantly at national level. I mean, new healthcare would follow great science, and I think we need that great science in Europe. And we need to also invest in education, not forgetting education at all levels, be it medical education, life science education, data education. Europe needs skilled workforce in the research, health research, and in healthcare, and they are all connected. The other thing is to break the silos, because today we are doing a lot of things in our own little world. Even if I look at life sciences, medical devices separate, pharmaceuticals separate, other products separate. We need to get out of siloed thinking and to look at consistency. And you talked about environment. Do you know that in pharma legislation you have how many references to legislation in making in chemicals and environment? If we don't look at impact of that, at complexity it may create, we would really lose out. So I think it's important to look not only at impact assessment and competitiveness assessment, but consistency and break the silos. And the third thing I think I'd like is to create that, start predictivity. So that not that a signal is sent not only to industry, but also to the young people that enter education and science education today, that they have perspectives in the future, that they would be an ecosystem in Europe where public, private, academia, industry can work together and create something together. So I think this predictivity with IP, I'm sorry to say it again, but I think it's important, with investment in science and de-siloing, really creating more consistency across the board. These are the three things I think could make a change, possibly.
Don't feel sorry to say the word IP because, all these things, as you're saying, there has to be interconnection. Every little part of the puzzle is important.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a question that Magda, well, building upon what Magda's talking about, obviously young people are going to be voting in this election. If we're saying, health is something that the EU cares about, how are you going to, what would be your message to them? How are you going to show them? If we're talking about, already the workforce and people are leaving, they're disenfranchised. We know salaries are bad. So where can the initiatives come from the parliament to provide this, better skills for them, using technology like AI, quantum even? Where is it coming from? Where are the ideas?
I think that the attitude of the institution should be of service.
Nice.
Partners of the companies, partner of the citizens, partner of, because and being partners and working together create a legal frame that gives security, give opportunity, help the initiative of the population and helps to develop a future, not only in the values aligned with the European Union, because I see that the European Union is focused on, as I said at the beginning, green transition and digital transition. Mm-hmm. Okay, but there are more topics.
Yes.
And vocation in the future. So why we have to be all focused on that? For example, health. The truth is that it's not a priority. It's an issue, as we see. We are
it's
talking
a necessity.
About it.
Yeah. It's a necessity.
But I would like to see that European Union put the same energy in health, or also into create opportunities. Sometimes, not even think by the Commission. Because the future is unexpected, and the creativity of human being. And I see sometimes the institution, a European institution, is not working as a partner, not as a partner of the member states, not as a partner of the citizens. We see, and I think that this is will be other, it will be a great approach. I think that create the environment, create the legal frame work that where the initiative can have a space, and when somebody wants to put their effort, have a space to have at least the opportunity to find an their own work and to have their own incomes too, because as we see, and it's true that I'm from Spain and we are suffering a lot. We see a lot of unemployment. We see the youth without the opportunity to create even their own future, not living.
They've lost faith.
Sorry?
They've lost faith.
Yeah. So it's true. I'm really worried about the youth, the next generation, because I see that the standard that, for example, they don't want to marry, to found a family. They have not initiative. They see the institution as borders, as difficulties, and sometimes they prefer to just stay, stop and stuck. They are stuck. I see that we have a generation stuck, and they are like not a goal in their life, a meaning of a life, because everything looks like difficult. And I think that these burdens that we see in the companies, because we are building a future that looks like difficult, but it's a difficulty that is not real. It's legal. Yeah. It's more created by us as the politician, as the institution, than the real one, because it should be more easy. I want to put effort, and then I should have
I think the beautiful
a reward.
I'm going to use the word beautiful for the EU here, because the beautiful thing about it, not many journalists use the word beautiful for the EU, I'm sure, but the beautiful thing about it is that it's an extra layer on top of all the national governments, and then it can reach out and touch the people and say, look, we're still here for you. So do you think, MEP Bussoy, as someone that's now going towards the national side of it, I mean, how's it? Do you think that the EU is playing this role, can play this role, can do it better? It can reach the citizens where member states are perhaps failing them sometimes or not quite getting that connection right? He smiles.
In healthcare, it is difficult because, as it was said before, and it's well known by everyone involved and by many that are watching us, it is not easy to change the treaty. It will be difficult discussion because it's not only about this. If it would be about healthcare, the discussion will be easier. But of course, when we decide to change the treaties, many other issues that are not so supported by a majority will arise. So it is difficult.
So you would have a problem at the member state level because they would feel as if Brussels is trying to take back power from them. Is that what you're saying when it comes to treaties?
What we experienced in the last years is that with the current treaty architecture, European institutions could be more involved. They already have some prerogatives on cross-border healthcare, on the European healthcare program, on European Medicine Agency, on pharma legislation, on digital solutions in healthcare, on innovation. So here, with legislative or policy initiatives, we could continue to be even more active in the coming years. And also financing. We have the current structure until 2027. the European multi-annual budget. Of course, we had this RRF, Resilience and Recovery Facility, but we are looking to the future also to invest more in our industry, to create new tools, to create new programs, new initiatives. And beside the twin transition, it was mentioned, the digital and the green transition, beside the strategic technologies of the future, I believe that innovative solution and innovation in healthcare could find a place in the future EU initiatives. Here, of course, by doing more, I believe the citizens will feel a little bit more protected also by EU institutions in healthcare. Replacing national authorities or local authorities is difficult because most of the decisions, the quality of the services...
I wouldn't say the conversation is really about replacing them. It's maybe about giving them a helping hand. More targeted approach or
then
funding?
Then coordinating better national initiatives and national approaches with a European vision and building our European Union in healthcare, this could be a good objective for the next mandate.
And what would you, how would you say, ideally, that the European Union should then deliver on this health union? It's done quite a lot now, obviously, this last
done
mandate.
Quite a lot. First, we have to finalize legislation, the pharma legislation, see what other future initiatives could be. Then accelerate a little bit EU Beating Cancer Plan and looking also to the member states that they should deliver on this, update and put in practice their national plans. Looking also to the cardiovascular diseases as a next step. Of course, it's not the same as the cancer. And also the solutions are a little bit different. But clearly, we need to look to cardiovascular diseases and other non-communicable diseases. Then, of course, digitalization. We have already some rules on how we use the data and we should better use the data, primary and secondary use, but also interconnect different instruments like the electronic records and not only, and create a digital healthcare union also, if I could say that. Mobilizing more EU money for healthcare. For Romania, for instance, it's not only the centralized programs like EU for Health or Horizon Europe, Mission for Cancer, the health trend in Horizon Europe, but also we have more than 5 billion from cohesion funds and from RRF to build new hospitals, even to cancer hospitals, to have screening and prevention campaigns, also to invest in research in healthcare. So we can mobilize even more EU funds in the future from different instruments.
But, if I'm a hospital within a national healthcare system, my staff is depleted, my, you know, all the different parts of the hospital, things are sort of breaking down, nothing's really functioning, we don't have such a great access to medicine for all of our patients, things are difficult. How do I reach out to, where do I get my funding from, who do I go to? Well, I know people will be watching thinking, okay, the EU has all of these funds, but how? How do I get it?
The hospitals are struggling indeed, but I don't think there is any hospital in EU in a so bad situation.
Perhaps not, we don't know.
Yeah.
Then I've given you the doomsday. So this is doomsday hospital, okay? Doomsday hospital is having a really bad time. Where does it get its funds from?
No, depends, because the cohesion funds, the decision of the member states, how they could use it. So if we talk as hospital in Romania, they could have a lot of opportunities from EU funds. Actually, we have now 400 hospitals in total, and 200 hospitals will have their digital solutions in place via EU funds from RRF. So half of the hospitals will have their telemedicine solution, their integrated solution for the patients, for the health records, using European funds. Others will buy equipments from that. This is not the situation in the Western and North countries where the cohesion funds are not so important. But
let me also ask you about one
more competitive in accessing the Horizon Europe, for instance. Mm-hmm. And many hospitals have also this research structure that could be helped from European funds. So many opportunities. They cannot change drastically the situation, as I said, mm-hmm. but could improve some of the issues.
So obviously there's lots of tools and levers for member states, for different actors within, you could say, the health value chain. But from what I understand, 20% of the EU for health budget is being relocated. That's 1 billion euros. Have we had a reason why? Do we know where that's going?
Yes, of course.
And what then happens?
Because we need to support Ukraine. We needed to mobilize some of the existing funds plus additional mm-hmm. funds by the member states to give the necessary support to Ukraine for the next years. And unfortunately, some of the cuts were from the EU for Health program and Horizon Europe. We had a discussion in ENVI committee with Commissioner Kyriakides and the Director General of DG Sante. They will look to the decommitments because usually not all the funds are spent at the end of the period. We also have the solution to balance the situation from the annual budget. We can mm-hmm. add each year until 2027 some additional funds just to rebalance this 1 billion that was cut. And of course, maybe this will be the internal decision, but it will be in a close cooperation and dialogue with European Parliament. You know that a significant part from the EU for Health program will go to HERA to be better prepared for the future, to strategic stocks, to stockpiling, actually, to some of these sections. I hope that looking to all these internal arrangements, none of the essential programs, digitalization, prevention campaigns, also building better programs for national authorities will be affected. So some rearrangements will be made and some additional money could come from the yearly budget.
Mm. Well, I mean, definitely, you know, Ukraine does need everyone's support.
And let's not forget that we started from 400 million and we went to 5.1 billion. Now mm-hmm. it's 1 billion less. It's a bad signal. It's a bad signal for the future. But I think, first of all, we can understand that we need to help Ukraine.
Yes.
And second, we can find solutions to balance this.
Hmm. And definitely we need to support Ukraine. And what I was saying is I think the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, they're having a meeting at NATO. And he was saying that, you know, they're going to provide more funds for Ukraine through their multi-financial framework budget as well. So we know that there's a reason why. But, Richard, how does that look, do you think, to voters then? Because it always comes down to that, doesn't it? That we understand, voters, I mean, obviously understand that there are global crises going on. There is a country in desperate need of every member state's help. But if 1 billion euros of an EU fund that could perhaps touch them at some point is being taken away, is that why, you know, we see how people vote and there's a potential for the far right to gain a bigger piece of the European Parliament. Do you think that this affects people's voting patterns then, when they see that the money that they need for something is being taken for something else, even if they understand the reason why?
I'm not sure to what degree the average citizen follows the EU budget cycles, but to the wider point around prioritisation of EU funds, obviously needs do change, but I think the debate for the next financial one has already started, and we need to make sure that wherever the EU sets important ambitions and goals, it adequately supports that, and that needs to be a big part of the next financial round debate. But the other thing is thinking as well about how we can spend the money smartly and cleverly, because there are some areas where, for example, you can have very high return on investment on, for example, twinning cancer centres. It doesn't cost so much money, but it can be radically helpful for some countries to learn from the very best cancer centres in another country, or to have something like the European Code Against Cancer, which is 12 key things that any citizen can do in any country to reduce their cancer risk, promoting something like that. Mm-hmm. That is not a high cost, but a large reward. We've seen with the Leading Cancer Plan as well, where you've got, for example, a skills shortage all over Europe and in a sector of the oncology workforce, investing in a European qualification, using European societies to help develop the content, all of that brings high reward. We also see, though, the complexity of EU funding, where sometimes good people with good ideas are not quite able to access the system because mm-hmm. it requires almost a qualification itself to get
through
the
funding. Yeah, it's complicated, but once you get there, you get there, yeah.
So I think there's lots of scope to look again at how we spend the money and how we structure the funding. A lot of programs are co-funded, which can also put people off because they have to find the resources from somewhere, and occasionally that resource isn't there, and that can actually lead to discrimination against lower-resourced countries as well. So it's two things. We need to look ahead to the next financial run, but also look at how we're spending the money as it currently is.
Okay, and so Magda, your thoughts then? I mean, does it worry you that funding is leaving, even if you understand why?
I think I do agree that there is an emergency now that needs to be dealt here and now, but we are looking at the very long term. And I think if we look at the long term, I also agree that, well, there would never be an infinite amount of money for healthcare. We need to be...
Because it also needs to be spent really wisely.
It needs to be spent wisely,
that
exactly.
That radical changes, I mean, they're still not quite carrying through, are they? Because we can't keep, for example, a healthcare system, it can't keep operating the way that it is right now. It needs to change and move forward with the times.
Correct. And I think that we need to look also, maybe lesson learned from COVID. How do we partner better? How do we collaborate better? How do we direct the funding? And Richard, you said it, smarter. How do we work not only on creating new solutions, but also at deploying them, at looking at healthcare systems readiness? And that just can mean as simple things as what you've said about data in hospitals, standardization, digitization, etc. I mean, we need to spend some money on deployment of what Europe generates, and not only at creating new solutions, but making sure that they reach the patients in the end. And that it's also about healthcare system organization. This is also innovation in, I insist again, on collaboration and partnering, because I think that there are many resources in Europe that are untapped because collaboration doesn't happen. And that can be, how can we collaborate differently or work differently on managing, for example, chronic diseases and managing health rather than just managing disease, helping people to manage their health rather than just... So I think that shift also needs to happen, that we look more holistically at prevention, treatment, care. We de-silo the budgets because probably there are some economies of scale that can be created if we look at healthcare more holistically. And I think EU can do a lot to support countries in that transition. And that's where we need to look at European Union's funding, how Europe can support, enable innovation and support transition into more health outcomes for people.
Okay, well, this debate is going to so many... It's a beautiful conversation we're having, but I'm quite aware that we've got 10 minutes left. So this is a question I'm going to read out for the panellists now. It's from the audience. We ask you a question. Obviously, we couldn't have a live Slido, Q&A with the audience, so we asked them a question, and this is the one they came with. The question is, what is the future of the European Parliament Senate Committee? Will it be permanent? Will it be standalone? Is it going to have legislative powers? So perhaps you'd like to take that on. What happens to the SAMP committee?
I don't know, maybe my colleagues have more information, but of course what I can say is that I think that it's a need. Because I think that MB committee is more focused in environment, and I think that health and MB is not fixed well always. And we need deputies health-oriented. And as we see, all the citizens will appreciate to see the politicians taking care of this goal of health. And as we have been talking, it's not always a big expense, a wise expense, a transparency. And I think that the collaboration between the member states with a good practice will be welcome. Well, because it's something that we can do without even huge invest. And it's really make a European Union a union, you know, sharing the knowledge and sharing the professional. And so I guess, and I hope that, I don't know if we'll have a legislative power or not, but because as we see, health is a competence of the member state. Yeah. But many times just talk, that just give the space, is a step forward. And at national level, the professional and the patients really, really appreciate it. So I hope that we have the chance to have a special committee on health. Maybe Mr. Yes, Rousseau.
This is the discussion now. I believe that having a subcommittee in the second part of this mandate was the first step to have a proper, for the first time, committee on healthcare in the European Parliament with full legislative powers. If we have a committee, then it's legislative. Of course, maybe the number of legislative initiatives will not be so many as we have in ITRE committee, for instance, or environment. On those areas where the EU institutions have more prerogatives, yes, and where the legislation is decided almost 100% or in a large part at the EU level. But even with just a few legislative initiatives, but with a lot of non-legislative, own initiative reports and other policy initiatives that could be discussed, debated via reports, in hearings, and all the activities that a committee in European Parliament are performing, it will be an important step forward to have healthcare as a more preeminent issue at the EU level. For my political party, it's a high priority to have this committee in place, and I'm very confident that this will happen. Of course, the discussion about the security and defense, because this is also now a subcommittee of AFET, of External Affairs Committee, with the war and our clear ambition to invest more in defense in Europe. Defense was the fourth pillar of what Mr. Letta proposed at the beginning. I mentioned the pillars. So these two new areas that achieved preeminence in the past years and months, this should be reflected also in the new structure of the parliament.
Brilliant. Okay, and with that, I'll allow everyone to have just a final statement. Where's the future of health for the EU going, Richard?
Well, I think the future of health is an ongoing success story for the EU. I think it's where it can make a real difference. And for citizens, when they ask the question, what does the EU do for me? I think more and more in the future, they'll be thinking, well, the EU helps me with my health, my family, and the health systems that in my country. And I think the cancer plan is just the start of showing that. And I think there's many more things to come.
And please carry on. For me, I would like to push, foster this cardiovascular motion of resolution or report or even a special committee for the next mandate. Maybe we have this health health committee. Maybe it could be one of the first reports that we have handled, because as we see the great success of beating cancer plan, I would like to have a cardiovascular disease European strategy also.
Magda?
I think I hope that Europe would be able to accelerate progress. It's not just about making legislation, but implementing legislation and making sure that things happen and removing barriers as quickly as they appear. So a bit of acceleration in decision making and in coordinating countries to do work, for example, on clinical trials and their approval, things like that. The second is partner for better health and looking at how we can, for example, for management of chronic diseases, non-communicable diseases, but also about vaccination, immunization, and the interlink between the two. How can we partner better for health outcomes? And I think that the EU can do that. By the way, whatever the decision is about the health committee or not, health needs to stay as a key debate in Europe, and we cannot lose it. And the last one is, I'd like to highlight that again, in the future, I'd love to see Europe as a generator of new health solutions for people. So having the clear signal to public and private researchers that health research is something worth investing here in Europe, that would be absolutely wonderful.
Nicely said. Okay, to our host, take us out.
The future of healthcare in Europe, I believe that we'll have better legislation and a proper implementation. And in the next period, we need to see the implementation on what we legislated, and looking also to other areas where we need to revise current legislation or propose a new one. Then, of course, I hope we'll see a European Commission, maybe with the Vice President, which has also the portfolio on healthcare, more involved in assisting the member states to do more, to have less bureaucracy, to implement better the legislation, to coordinate better between the member states. Then, of course, in the parliament, more preeminent role of healthcare with the permanent committee, as it was discussed and explained just before. Then more funds invested in healthcare, more EU funds invested in healthcare from the research program, from the RRF, from other instruments. And finally, to see the pharmaceutical industry as part of the industrial deal that we need to build for the next 5 years.
Okay, well, listen, this has been a really great debate, I think, and I hope everyone watching has enjoyed it as we discussed and plotted the future of health for Europe. So thank you to all the panelists. It's been a great conversation. You've been watching an AstraZeneca online debate supported by Euractiv. Thank you so much for watching, and let's hope that health does get its place in Europe. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.